On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The average Detroit public school student misses a month of classes.
Why don't they report every time my kids miss a couple days?
They don't report.
I hate that.
It's George Eason's job to hold their parents accountable.
We see that the parent is willfully keeping the child out and not sending the child to school, then we will take every means necessary to enforce the law.
Detroit gets serious about attendance later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Good afternoon, listeners. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. My name's Amanda Compton, and I'll be your host today. I have some really great guests. Starting off with me is George Kuhar. We'll be talking about his event tonight. We'll also talk to The Rock Dump about a Wednesday clinic that they're having for women, and we'll be talking to the runner extraordinaire, local legend Jeff Rose. We'll be calling from just outside of Boulder. He'll be running the Iditarod Trail Invitational later this month. And then we'll talk to Eaglegrass about a pretty cool program they have to help out some middle schoolers. So that, Writer's Almanac, and more coming up in just a second.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A South Dakota legislative committee has killed a bill requiring drug testing for those who apply for public assistance. The bill was opposed by a Native American lawmaker. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The South Dakota House Health and Human Services Committee has killed a bill requiring drug tests for people who apply for temporary assistance for needy families. The bill originally required drug tests for those seeking supplemental food assistance, but the head of South Dakota's Department of Social Services says federal law does not allow that. Democratic Representative Ed Ironcloud III of Porcupine opposed the measure and the way it was brought to the committee.
The individuals that are sponsoring these bills, if you truly, sincerely care about the people of South Dakota, regardless of race or gender, I believe that you would start rolling up your sleeves and doing some work today and not bringing bills in at the spur of the moment and forcing the issue and not having the proper information, fiscal notes, etc. You know, I just think this is a bad bill.
The committee deferred the bill to the 41st legislative day, a quirk in South Dakota's legislature law that essentially kills a bill since lawmakers meet for a maximum of 40 days. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
Native American students in Seattle public schools have high dropout rates. While the school district is exploring ways to keep kids in school, a group of parents who started the Native American Education Alliance is addressing the issue. In the second of a two-part series, Eilish O'Neill reports.
Sarah Kelly, who is White Earth Chippewa, is one of the co-chairs of the Native American Education Alliance. She says that Seattle's teachers often say insensitive or inaccurate things about Native Americans.
Things like, reservations exist to preserve culture. Things like, we live in teepees. Things like, we get money from casinos, or we use peyote as a drug, and other really inappropriate things. Things, and they're just absolutely false. And teachers are spouting this in the classroom as fact.
The Education Alliance emphasizes that it's not just cultural incompetency that pushes Native kids out of school. Sarah Sense Wilson, who is Oglala Sioux and Northern Cheyenne, is the other co-chair of the alliance. She adds that suspensions and expulsions of Native youth contribute to the high dropout rate.
You know, our kids are being targeted, being racially profiled as being addicts, and not getting the help they need if it is true. But we've got proven examples of students who were not high, were not intoxicated, and we're still suspended from school.
The Education Alliance tries to collaborate with and give recommendations to the district. They'd like to see cultural competency training for teachers, and they want fewer Native kids suspended and expelled. But Sarah Sense Wilson says the Alliance isn't waiting for the district to act. They're also actively trying to keep Native American students in school.
We meet every Tuesday, and there's tutoring, there's cultural activities, there's food, there's opportunity for multi-generational families to come together and to exchange, and to connect with each other.
These weekly gatherings began in early 2009, and many of the students who attended them regularly have gone on to college. For National Native News, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Seattle, Washington.
California Governor Jerry Brown appoints a tribal advisor. Brown announced the appointment of Cynthia Gomez Tuesday. She will serve as the governor's tribal advisor and executive secretary for the Native American Heritage Commission. Gomez is the chief justice of the Shingle Springs Band of Miwok Indians. She also has held state positions in transportation, housing, and the environment. Brown established the position by executive order to improve the government-to-government relationship with tribes. During this month in 2006, the first meeting of the Native American Caucus of the Oklahoma House of Representatives took place. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC, CLIP, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Good afternoon, Juno listeners and beyond. I've got George Kuhar in the studio. George, hey, thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you.
George, tonight is a big night for you. Can you let us know what is going on?
Well, tonight is the third installment of the KRNN concert series. I missed the first two, unfortunately. I was told that the first one was folk and traditional musics, and then the second one was jazz, and our hostess tonight, Katie Bosler, came and saw me at the Rookery at the beginning of January, and she had the idea, we should do the next one, singer-songwriter. And it kind of went from being singer-songwriter. At first, I thought I was going to round up some songwriters, but we didn't have time to get that all together. And so instead, we just did a showcase of me and my wife's music, my wife Bridget Cross, of our music and our the stuff that we do together. We try and mix it up and keep it versatile in a town as small as Juneau. We don't want to play out the same thing too much.
And so what sort of stuff are you going to be presenting tonight?
Well, the first half of the show is going to be a project that I've been working on recently, which I've been billing gospel music for an Aquarian age. And the second half of the show, we're going to touch a little bit on some of the silent film scores that we've worked on, and then we'll do a little bit of our electronic music project, which is called Playboy Spaceman.
Can you explain a little bit more detail about the gospel songs from an Aquarian age?
Oh, sure. You know, I'm one, and I think a lot of people feel this way, that there's a big change happening right now, obviously, with our communications. The way we talk and communicate and receive information all around the world is changing at a very rapid rate. So there's a new kind of language, I think, that's being born, a new mythology and a new religion even. Whether we're comfortable calling it those terms or not, I don't know, but it's something very new and something very real, and I want to address it, and I want to recycle and keep the old things that have been useful and have always been useful, the very human aspects, and I want to apply them to the current landscape, the current setting of the times.
So the current landscape being the Aquarian age, and then the useful things being the gospel part of it.
That's right. What I call gospel music is I would call maybe Buddy Tabor a gospel singer. Anybody you know it when you hear it. You hear somebody sing from their soul. It's not coming from their physical body. It's coming from somewhere else. You know it because it moves you somewhere else besides your physical body. And that's where I like to go with my music and when I sing.
Great. I wanted to ask you, I watched a couple of YouTube videos, and I also saw one of your videos in the Jump Film Festival. How many of those do you make a year?
I really just got started on that. Last winter was... It's because of the Jump Film Festival. I'm grateful to Pat, Aaron, and Lou for organizing the Jump Film Festival and giving a platform for emerging filmmakers, amateur filmmakers, and even professional filmmakers in our hometown in Southeast Alaska to put their works out there. So I just got started doing that last winter. Was my first submission to the Jump Film Festival, and I really enjoyed it, and I hope to make a submission. It's biannual, so I hope to make a submission every winter and every summer, and hopefully I'll be making more in between, too.
And you play a couple of different instruments in the video, so how many instruments and soundboards and equipment are you familiar with and adept at, and your wife?
Well, she plays keyboards and bass, and I started out as a guitar player. Along the way, I picked up other things. I lived with a band that I was in for a while, so I learned how to play bass and how to play keyboards and how to play drums. I don't have a drum set, and I live in a triplex, so a drum set wouldn't go over well. So instead, I love the drums, I really do. So instead, I have to program them, which is fun. And it helps to know the instrument a little bit before you play it virtually.
I'm sure. Is Bridget the woman in the videos?
I'm sorry?
Is Bridget the woman portrayed in your videos?
Yes.
Okay. And so she'll be there tonight. And it sounds like you guys are doing kind of a mix of the solo, some solo works as well as some conversation interview.
That's right.
What is the conversation going to entail?
Katie Bosler, KDB, she hosts the Monday Night Tidelines. She's just going to ask us some questions about our musical background, what influences us, what we hope to say with our music.
Great. So if you guys want to get any more information, it sounds like you should go ahead and show up tonight. Can you tell us the specifics about the concert?
It's at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. It starts at 7 o'clock. I believe there are tickets still available. You can buy them online at the KRNN website, or you can come by the K2 Studios and pick them up there. Or you could buy them at the door.
Great.
Yeah.
Anything
there'll
else?
Be I'm sorry. And there'll also be beer and wine and snacks.
Oh.
Too.
Thanks. Duly noted. Anything else you wanted to add?
I hope everybody's having a great day out there.
Thanks. Well, I have some music from you, by you, coming up, and then we're going to hear from someone else. So thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Amanda.
Bye. The time is 3:15, and we're going to take a quick look at the weather. Today, mostly cloudy. Slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Highs around 40 degrees. East wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, rain is likely with lows around 33 degrees. East wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, rain's likely. Highs around 40 degrees. Thursday night, tomorrow night, rain. Lows around 33. And then through the weekend, it looks like it's going to stay pretty warm with some chance of rain and then snow around Saturday night to Sunday. So with me right now, I have a couple of representative staff members from the Rock Dump, Jess, who's an instructor, and Vicky. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
And I understand you guys are here to talk about a particular class at the Rock Dump or a series of class. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell me what you do there, and then go ahead and talk about your class.
Hi, I'm Jess Brown, and I'm the instructor for the women's class. So on every Wednesday, we have ladies' night, and that means we have $7 day passes for any women who show up, and we also have a women's class from 6:30 until 8. And so I have Vicky here, who is one of my students, and she's been coming to my class.
Yes, I'm a student. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She's been coming to my class for the past 2 or 3 years now. So,
yeah. Were you a novice when you first started?
Oh, absolutely. The reason that I actually did it was because my entire life, when I was a youngster, I couldn't stand on a kitchen chair and look down without getting weak in the knees. So I just thought, you know, there's one way to get over fear of heights, and that's to challenge yourself. And
you take it head on.
And it's so much fun. I can't. It's something that can't be described. It's something that you just have to come and do. And I think especially for women, at least for this woman, it's not only is it challenging and tons of fun, but it's really empowering too, because it has a lot to do with strength and endurance. And I think that's something that women tend to challenge themselves with from time to time. So
great. So you've been going there for 3 years now.
Uh-huh. This is my third winter.
So was it intimidating at all when you first started?
Not really. I mean, it was a little intimidating as far as doing it, but it's the equipment at the Rock Dump is an incredibly safe environment, and Jess has been my partner all along. I kind of tease her because if you could see us here, Jess is this tiny little person, and I'm rather a big person, and I always say it's very ironic that the tiniest person in the gym is belaying the biggest person in the gym. But she's, you know, we've been partners for a long time doing it as well as others. And once people get used to it, you form a trust. And then there's no fear at all.
Great. Yeah. And so tell me a little bit more about the class, Jess.
So the class, like I said, is every Wednesday, and it's open to whoever wants to come.
Does it start on a particular time?
It starts at 6:30, and it goes until 8. And for members of the gym, it's $5 each session. And if you're not a member, it's $15. So it's super accessible. And
when do sessions start?
At 6:30.
I mean, all year?
Oh,
or is there a particular... Okay, so every Wednesday.
They're ongoing, except for the summer. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you get outside much in the summer then for climbing?
Hopefully. We'll see. We'll see what happens here.
Okay. And how many people do you generally have come on a given night?
Well, our numbers have been climbing lately. We've had about 10 or 11 the past couple weeks, and it's just growing each week.
And do they pair off?
We do, and a lot of times we'll switch it up and we'll just sort of go with the flow and partner up as needed.
Great.
Yeah.
Do you have any other details you want to share about the class, such as equipment? Do you need your experience level required, et cetera?
Sure. There is no special equipment or skills necessary. We're pretty relaxed in that we teach anyone who is interested in learning whatever they want to learn. So if you don't know how to belay, you don't know how to tie a knot, we can start there and go on. And then, I'm not sure, do you have anything you want to add?
I have gotten, I'm to the point where I've gotten my own equipment, but the equipment is great there at the Rock Dump. Certainly deciding if it's something that you really want to invest in. And as far as the outdoor climbs, I myself am really hoping this spring that's the goal, is to try to is to do some outdoor climbs.
Would that be a trip, or would you find somewhere locally to do that?
Well, we could go out at the sea cliffs, out the road, yeah.
We were talking about that. We're also talking possibly maybe the Women's Club sometime in the future of possibly doing a trip to maybe, what, down into Bryce Canyon or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Anything's possible. But
that'd be great.
Mm-hmm. We have to give it a shot and see how we like climbing.
Well, maybe
climbing
with climbing numbers, they'll have climbing interest in that too.
Yeah.
Great.
Definitely.
Anything else you guys wanted to add? Just come on
sure.
down.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's really open to whomever, and
even if you're afraid of heights.
Exactly. Even if you're afraid of heights, we'll make you feel safe and secure. And it's been great to see so many women come out and just have fun and not care about their own inhibitions, you know. They really just let go and go for it.
And since the audience can't see me, I'm like almost 60, so it's not something that you have to be 20 or 30 or below. Quite a few of the women in the women's class actually are my, you know, around my age, in their 50s, and I'm probably the oldest, but I usually am. But anyway, it's not something that age, if you are in relatively good shape, it's something that most people can do.
And if it truly empowers you, it has a positive effect on your whole life.
It has. It really has changed my life in little ways. I don't mean to sound, you know,
cheesy.
Yeah. But yeah. But it really has. It has. I've lost weight. I feel better about myself.
You're gorgeous.
I'm stronger. Thank you. Thank you.
She's anyway. Got some awesome muscles over here.
Yeah. It's fun. And the class itself, just the women that are in the class, are just a hoot. We have such a good time.
Yeah. Oh my God. And we also have some special events coming up. So this weekend, we've got a Valentine's special. And that means on Friday, we have any gear that we have, so mainly shoes, would be 10% off. On Saturday, there's a reduced price for any couples who come in to climb. So whether that's your significant other, your roommate, your climbing partner, two people for $20 total. And then on Sunday, I'm offering a couples class from 12 to 1:30 for free if you buy a day pass or
a month
pass.
Are you going to turn the heat up in the building and off?
No. Okay. Well, hopefully we'll talk about, you know, the importance of communication and trust.
Ah.
Yeah.
And the music. We can't forget about great sound system at the Rock Drum.
So. We'll put on some good tunes for sure. But other than that, we've also got a boulder jam that goes on every other Tuesday. And I believe the next one is on the 14th. And that starts around 5 in the afternoon. And so that's a bunch of those guys who are doing the short, hard problems, you know, not on the
You guys
top
can't
rope.
See Jess out there, but she's actually like flexing and kind of moving her body. Those guys, okay.
and we also have serious climbing days every Thursday from starting at 5:00, and that's more focused on specific strength training and really working those muscles. And then
serious
climbing day.
Okay.
Serious. And then we also have a homeschool program, which is every Wednesday, and I believe the new session starts on Wednesday, March 7th.
Well, to meet Jess and get empowered, it sounds like tonight you can show up at 6:30, and next mm-hmm. Wednesday, and next Wednesday. is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, it sounds good.
All right, ladies, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 8th of February, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Elizabeth Bishop, born in Worcester, Massachusetts, 1911. Went to Vassar, wrote poetry there, and from her mentor, the poet Marianne Moore, she learned that she could write poems that were not about big ideas like love or death, but just about looking at objects. It's the birthday of John Grisham, born Jonesboro, Arkansas, 1955. He was a successful lawyer. He set out to write a novel about one of his court cases. It was called A Time to Kill. It came out in 1989, did not do well. John Grisham then read an article in Writer's Digest magazine about the rules of suspense, and he used that formula to write a thriller about a law student who realizes the firm that he works for is connected to the mafia. And that was The Firm, a huge bestseller in 1991. Kate Chopin, born in St. Louis, 1850, on this day. She came from a successful family. She was a young socialite, a Southern belle. She got married, had six children. She was a devoted wife and mother. But then her husband died, and then her mother died, and Kate Chopin was depressed. Her doctor encouraged her to write because she was a good letter writer. And so over a period of about 15 years, Kate Chopin wrote almost 100 short stories and two novels, At Fault and The Awakening, in 1899. It was The Awakening that caused a controversy at the time, the story of a woman who gives up being a wife and mother, has an affair, and walks into the sea, perhaps a suicide. It was heavily censored and criticized at the time, now considered an important work by an early feminist author, The Awakening. And it's the birthday of Neil Cassidy, born in Salt Lake City, 1926. A con man in and out of jail, came to New York City, met Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, who idolized him. To them, Neil Cassidy embodied everything that they embraced in theory. Neil Cassidy was the inspiration for the character Dean Moriarty, the hero of Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Allen Ginsberg wrote about him, and Neil Cassidy appears in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe as a friend of Ken Kesey's. Here's a poem for today by Paul Hostofsky entitled Exegesis. We couldn't have been more than 12 or 13 sitting on that green bench in the late 60s or early 70s, me and Michael Zucker, who was much more savvy and world-weary than I, when I asked him to please explain the meaning of the words to a song by Carly Simon, who was simply gorgeous, that much was plain, after we'd resolved the essential question of whether or not she was wearing a bra in that photo of her with the blue top and thick lips on her album cover. "I don't get it," I said. "You're so vain, you probably think this song is about you, but the song is about him, isn't it?" I asked Zucker, holding my palm up in the air, like one who's trying to ascertain the truth about whether or not it has started to rain. Zucker looked away then, gingerly fingering the green slats, as though he were reading the carved names of the lovers and obscenities tactually. Then he took a deep breath and exhaled miserably, took the album cover out of my hands, and gazed a while at Carly Simon, who was gorgeous, famous, braless, and older than me and Zucker put together. "That's the point," he said. "She's in love with him." Exegesis, a poem by Paul Hostofsky from A Little in Love, A Lot, published by Main Street Rag, used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The time is just about 3:30. You're tuned in to Juno Afternoon. With me on the phone, I have Jeff Rose. Jeff, can you hear me down there?
Yeah, I can.
So could you introduce yourself and let us know where you are?
Yeah, I'm Jeff Rose, and I'm in Nederland, Colorado, outside of Boulder, Colorado, living down here during the fall and winter time, and generally missing Juno.
So Jeff is a Juno resident. He's here a lot of the summer when he's not racing. And you are getting ready. You're preparing for a pretty big event coming up at the end of the month, right?
Yeah, I'm gonna do an event called the Iditarod Trail Invitational. I'm starting on February 26th, and it's on the Iditarod Dog Sled Trail. essentially the first third of the trail, because the race I'm doing ends in McGrath. So it's only 350 of the close to 1,100 miles of the entire trail.
Just only 350 miles.
Yeah, a short one.
Yeah. have you done this race before?
I have. I've attempted it twice, and I've yet to finish. So I'm hoping for a little better luck and skill, I guess, this time around.
So just to inform some listeners who are unfamiliar with this, this is a race that follows the Iditarod Trail before the mushers go out, about a week before. And then it's divided into two categories. You can either go to McGrath, which is what Jeff is competing in, or go all the way on to Nome, which I think is called the impossible version, right? And so, Jeff, you're attempting it on foot, but then other people are doing it on bike and skis. Do you know about how many people or what percentage of the racers generally choose to pull sleds and do it on foot?
I think the race has a 50-person maximum for all three divisions. I think there's usually about 15 people on foot. The bike category is by far the most popular. But I haven't counted exactly how many foot people this year, but probably in the 15 to 20 range at the most.
And then who is, I mean, there's an award given to just the fastest male and female period, right? So it's not divisions on feet category.
Yeah. It's a pretty, low-key event in terms of, the award is you get a free entry into the race the following year if you're crazy enough to want to do it again, I guess. But yeah, they sort of just recognize the winner of the race overall. And it's, to this point, I think it's always been a biker that's actually won the race.
So is there an advantage to doing it on foot over a bike?
There could be. If it was kind of the perfect storm of trail conditions, it could be an advantage on foot. But generally, no, because there's, even in some of the worst years, weather-wise and trail-wise, there's usually a good 100 or 150 miles of trail that's good enough that the bikers are just cruising along at 10 or 12 miles an hour, and just in that stretch of the race, they can put so much distance on the foot competitors that it's, it really is a race of three different divisions, but the race itself officially recognizes one winner, or one man and one woman. So
it's a personal challenge for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not going there with any intention of trying to win, whether it's my foot division or the overall thing at all. It's just definitely trying to see if I can actually go that far on my feet.
So you've tried to do it two other times to McGrath on bike, was that right?
No, I tried it on foot both times. The first time I had an ankle, kind of an ankle and knee both that were bothering me, and dropped out at mile 150, and then the second time I came down with a pretty nasty chest cold like 2 days before the race started and made it like 70 miles before I dropped out. Suffered through pneumonia for 6 weeks after that.
So this isn't just whether or not you can cover 350 miles, even though that sounds like a huge feat. There's a lot of other obstacles involved. Could you explain some of those to people who are unfamiliar with the route?
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, so much more than just going 350 miles. The entire route is on the snow-packed, ice-packed Iditarod Trail in February. So weather's the obvious obstacle in terms of, whether or not you have big snowstorms or heavy wind or extreme cold. You're generally out there long enough that you're going to get some stretches where you have really difficult weather to deal with. The fastest anyone's ever done this event on foot is just under 5 days. And so, in interior Alaska in February, you're never going to get a five-day stretch where the weather's perfect. You're going to have something that you're dealing with that's pretty difficult. And then the trail surface is probably the key factor in terms of difficulty compared to covering a similar distance.
Like you're post-holing, or you just have to run a flat?
Yeah, Yeah, potentially. I mean, it can be really good trail, and if it hasn't snowed for several weeks before the race, it can get packed in. There's a lot of people out there on snow machines and dog sledders out, kind of training for the Iditarod, and some local villages along the way. So there's people out on the trail generally, but if it snows recently, the trail is essentially non-existent, and so you know it can. The trail surface itself can change the outcome of the race by 3 or 4 days at least. So it's not as simple as just your training to get physically fit to run 350 miles. You're also just really needing to take a lot of variables as they come.
Like it sounds like there's a huge mental variable too. Do you go through what's about the longest period you might go through without seeing another person?
I mean, easily a full 24 hours or more. I think even the first year I tried it and made it 150 miles, after like mile 70, I didn't really see anybody. And that was probably a 18 hour, 20 hour stretch, something like that. And that was, you know, in the earlier part of the race where you're generally in a little more civilized area and you're kind of closer to some of the other racers. And as the race sort of thins out later on, I think it's even more remote. And there's five official checkpoints along the way. But when you're talking about a race that's taking you 7, 8, 9 days, potentially you're going to have stretches sometimes where you don't even hit a checkpoint in an entire day.
You're pretty sane in some respects, but I would imagine that, like, this isn't a race for the average person. So what are some of the other people like who are out there?
it definitely draws a really kind of eclectic and eccentric and really just sort of odd bunch of folks. And there's actually, for whatever reason, a lot of European folks come over and do the event. I think there's probably close to half the field this year are foreigners, mostly Europeans. But it's definitely a lot of, you know, just a lot of really what you would expect, really hearty, sort of just very individualistic, independent, stoic type folks that just have this ability to just keep marching along at 2 or 3 miles an hour for 15 to 20 hours a day, and then stopping and resting for 4 or 5 hours and doing it again the next day. And
there's something of interest that was on the news recently. The Iditarod is actually taking a different route this year. They're detouring something called Happy Steps. Could you explain a little bit about that and tell us how your course will be impacted, or if you're not going to do that detour?
That's news to me. I'm removed from a lot of state news being down in Colorado, but I haven't heard anything. We've been getting pretty regular race updates.
And I'm actually unfamiliar if that section, Happy Steps, is before or after McGrath, but I heard it's a really brutal part of the race. And some of the dogs.
Yeah, I believe it's before. You know, I believe it's actually just past the furthest I've been on the route, so I'm not entirely certain and familiar, but if my memory serves me right, I think it's probably around mile 170 of the Iditarod Trail. And it is kind of a notoriously difficult stretch and dangerous stretch for the dogs. My guess would be that our race will still take the original route, especially since I haven't heard anything. So
it is. You're doing the hard route.
Yeah, as far as I know. I would imagine I would have heard something by now. So.
Could you just tell us a little bit about how you're preparing for the race?
I've definitely been getting out and doing a lot of kind of time out on my feet, time out on just kind of slogging through the snow on snowshoes and cross-country skis. But I think even more importantly than the physical preparation, I've just been spending lots of time messing around with different gear choices and clothing choices. And I went out this past weekend and did a kind of an overnight trip. We finally got some good proper cold weather here in Colorado and a lot of snow, and so I was able to go out somewhat mimic race conditions. Maybe it was down to about zero the night I went out, which is a warm night on the Iditarod Trail, but it was about the best I've had to work with so far. But really, I think the kind of the logistical and the gear organization and preparation is just as important as the physical, because it's a long enough of an event physically that you can't really get yourself in shape to run 350 miles. Like, it's going to be really hard physically, no matter how much you train for it. And to some degree, you're almost better off going into it kind of fresh and not too worn out from training too much.
So maybe your strategy is to not train that much?
I mean, yeah, I'm probably training less total volume physical training than I do for like a 50 or 100 mile event. So yeah, a little bit less.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You're going to be carrying all of your gear, right? There's restrictions and rules on what you're allowed to have dropped off. Could you go into some of that?
Yeah, we're allowed two drop bags for the race, but they're only allowed to be expendables, and so it's food and batteries for our lights and fuel for a stove and things like that. But in terms of the actual clothing and any other gear for sleeping out and stuff, we have to carry all that from the start. And so I'll be dragging a sled, probably weighing in somewhere in the like 28 to 35 pound range, depending on how much food I have with me at any given time.
Will that be attached to your waist?
Yeah, just a simple little sled. So it's basically like a backpack that I have mounted on small little skis, and then a pole that comes up to my waist and attaches to a harness on my waist.
Do you have any like special thoughts or visualizations stored that you can recall if you get really stressed and frustrated and freaked out?
No, nothing really that I don't know. I just, you know, from the couple times I've tried this race, the main thing I just remember is it's really, really beautiful and aesthetically pleasing to be out in that country in the middle of winter. There's something kind of eerily beautiful about it, and I'm keeping myself really motivated by thinking about that.
Well, we all want to pledge our support for you and tell you good luck, and maybe we can have you back on air after the race ends to follow up and see how it went.
Yeah, that would be great. I might be passing through Juneau on my way back down here after the race. So.
Really?
Yeah, so I might be able to even be in person on the air. We'll see.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Jeff.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Children behave. That's what they say when we're together. And watch how you play.
I think we're the
KTOO is sponsored by the Alaska Club, with 18 locations statewide, celebrating its 25th anniversary. The Alaska Club, the way fitness should be. TheAlaskaClub.com.
The time is 3:46. I'm in the studio here with Jeffra Clow and Jim Calvin, and they're here to talk about a pretty cool program that goes on at Eagle Crest. Could you guys introduce yourself and tell me who you represent and about this program?
Sure, I'll take a crack. I'm Jim Calvin. I'm the
president of the Eagle Crest Foundation.
And I have to apologize. I just turned your mic on. Could you introduce yourself
again? I'll start again. Sure. I'm Jim Calvin. I'm president of the Eagle Crest Foundation. Foundation administers the Books to Board program, which Jeffra will talk about in a minute. I'll take a minute just to describe the foundation. Eagle Crest Foundation is a public nonprofit 501c3 organization that was created about 4 years ago now to really with the sole purpose of supporting Eagle Crest, and in particular supporting Eagle Crest through fundraising programs and programs to get more kids up on the mountain. The foundation led the effort to raise money for the Porcupine Lift and successfully raised $200,000 for that. So we're here to help support Eagle Crest in any way we can, and at the moment we're very, very pleased with the results of our Books to Boards program, which Jeffra can tell you about.
And I want to hear about that, but I have one question. How are you who are you comprised of? Like, are you a full-time member of, or is this your full-time job, or are you on the side of?
Yeah, no, we're a volunteer board. There's five or six of us. I have to do a head count, but all volunteers. And when it comes time to actually raise money, we recruit all the help we can around town. But the board will meet a couple times a year and just sort of talk about what programs we want to initiate that year and if there's any particular fundraising objectives we have. But strictly a volunteer board.
Wow. Yeah. Jeffra, do you want to talk to us about the program?
Sure. And kind of just to dovetail a little bit with Jim, the Eagle Crest Foundation has been a great asset to Eagle Crest and to the fundraising. I think we can safely say that the Porcupine Chair might not have been here as it is now without the help of the Eagle Crest Foundation. And so it's great to have that kind of organization associated with Eagle Crest. And the Books to Boards program is funded in part through the Eagle Crest Foundation. And that's a program that was started in 2009 where we started to look at getting more kids up to Eagle Crest that might not otherwise be able to get up there. And we decided we would target the middle schools. So we worked with the two middle schools and developed this program where kids who may be socially challenged, financially challenged, for whatever reason don't have the resources or the drive or the ambition or whatever it is in order to get up and use Eagle Crest and get outside and be active. And so we went to the schools, DeZonta Kahaney and Floyd Dryden, and said, hey, we're thinking about this program. What do you think? And both middle schools embraced it, and that kind of started us on the road to where we are right now.
And how are the students chosen?
The students are chosen through the schools. We've gone to the schools, and we say, hey, we have this great program. You pick the students to participate in this program.
And you give them a number?
Like we give them a number. Or... Mm-hmm. This year we have 105 kids that participate in this program, and they're all chosen by the schools. And some of the criteria that we look for are kids who, again, might not have the financial resources in order to get up to Eagle Crest. They may come from at-risk backgrounds or just for whatever reason not get up to Eagle Crest, and Eagle Crest could provide a necessary positive organization for them to participate in.
And what materially does it provide for students?
The students are given lift tickets up on the mountain for any non-school days. They're given equipment rentals, and they can either choose to ski or snowboard.
Given they're all equipment rentals, like for free. You can
for
use
free.
The skis,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Uh-huh. And bus transportation is for free. Helmets. We have gloves. We have goggles and clothing. For the students to wear. So it's what we tried to do when we developed this program is to try and look and see what are the barriers to keeping kids from using Eagle Crest. So we went, okay, we'll get rid of the equipment barrier, we'll get rid of the clothing barrier, the transportation barrier, the financial barrier, and see what happens.
Great. Well, it sounds like it's a big success. What's expected of children in order to maintain their membership?
Well, we do the tie-in with the books, with the education component, which we all feel is very, very important. So they have to show good behavior, and they have to be showing some improvement in their school. And they don't necessarily have to have an A average or B average or C average. They just have to be continually getting their work done, showing improvement, and developing positively as they grow through their scholastic studies.
So not only is the program fun, it's a scholastic motivator in a way, too.
It is. It is. And one thing that we added for the program 2 years ago, as we looked at all of the barriers for this program, we realized one huge social barrier, one huge barrier that we didn't count on was a social barrier. A lot of these kids don't have siblings or don't have friends that ski or snowboard up at Eagle Crest. So they were staying away for the fear of the unknown. So we've developed an after-school program at each of the middle schools that happens Wednesday afternoon and Thursday afternoon. And it's an after-school club where the books to boards get together. They talk about safety up at the mountain. They talk about how to tune their skis. They talk about respect and just a wide variety of topics. And that's given the kids, again, that social interaction.
So it's more
that is so important. Yes.
Jim, did you have anything?
Yeah, you might ask, well, why go to all this trouble to get a few more kids up?
Why go to all this trouble?
To get all the kids up on the mountain. And it, you know, those of us that are passionate about Eagle Crest and spend a lot of time up there have seen skiing and snowboarding really transform young kids that, you know, if they didn't have skiing and snowboarding, you know, who knows how they might, you know, it's a good motivator to stay out of trouble, to stay healthy, and it's a good healthy activity. So we've all been sort of powerfully moved by watching children who are changed by this healthy activity. So we really want to do, and really it's a sort of a mission of Eagle Crest itself. It's a mission of the foundation to make sure that everyone that wants to enjoy Eagle Crest can, so that there's no financial barriers especially, but again, as Jeffrey says, no social barriers. So it's really, it can really change kids' lives, and we've seen that, and we want to keep doing that.
So do most children who are interested or qualify get to do it, or is there some sort of rotation?
The schools do an application process, and it's different with each schools. And they have to, kind of an example, write a little bit of essay on why they want to participate, what they can think they can benefit by the program. And again, the schools pick it. And it's for the whole season. But if their behavior isn't up to where it's supposed to be, or scholastically they aren't, or they just don't use it, then they'll rotate new kids through. So we leave that up to the schools, and we just administer the project or the program.
Is there anything else either one of you asked? Are you up there skiing?
It's great skiing. Yeah. Go to Eagle Crest for sure.
Yep. And you can find more about Eagle Crest at skijuno.com and more about the Books to Boards program at eaglecrestfoundation.org.
So it's important for students who are interested in doing this to be aware that this program exists, right, so that they can apply?
That is. It's already kind of started for this season. It's an ongoing program. But I think it's important. What I wanted the community to realize that this is just another program that Eagle Crest and the Eagle Crest Foundation we do as part of our community outreach program. Again, as Jim said, it's important for us to get as many youth up at Eagle Crest as possible, remove all those barriers. We have the fifth grade passport program. We have the books to boards program. So we're really developing these programs to get people up to ski and snowboard at Eagle Crest, which is an amazing asset.
We should acknowledge the great work of Julie Jackson as well, who's sort of the day-to-day operations person for books to boards, and she's done a terrific job with the kids and the program.
She has. And the program is also funded in part by Mendenhall Auto Subaru and also a grant from Holland America Line. So it's, again, a program that utilizes some businesses, local businesses, and is just a great and amazing program.
As the word gets out about the foundation, we're also seeing more and more individuals make donations. It's a very worthy cause, and we would encourage people, if you want to learn more, log on. And
to where?
Well, you can go to skijuno.com. EagleCrestFoundation.org is a direct link, and certainly don't hesitate to call me if you want to learn more about the organization.
And your phone number?
My phone number is 586-6130.
Well, I applaud both of your efforts. Thanks a lot for coming in today.
Thanks for having us, Mary.
All
right, have a good day.
The time is 3:57. You've been listening to A Juno Afternoon with me, Amanda Compton, as your host. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Ock Bay area. Tune to K276 AF 103.1 in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens to K201 AM 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. An Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait here. KTOO K210AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. Tomorrow on A Juno Afternoon, host Matt Miller will talk with Flordolino Lagundini about this year's wearable art. We'll hear from Victoria Brown and Alicia Jones about the 12x12 community art installation at the City Museum. MJ Grand to talk about story time at the library, and Nancy DeCherney will tell us about events happening this weekend at Arts Up. That Writer's Almanac, music and more tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Taking a look at the weather tonight, periods of rain diminishing late, rain possibly mixed with snow. No snow accumulation, sorry about that. Lows around 30 degrees, east wind 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow we have rain developing through the afternoon with highs around 40 degrees and rain in the evening. And then Friday rain is likely. And through the weekend we've got a chance of rain, snow likely coming Saturday night. And thanks for tuning in.
Successful businessman, he's got a strong family, but you also have to go out and make the case that you have big, bold ideas.
Why some conservatives hear Mitt Romney and ask, where's the beef?
It's Wednesday, February 8th, and it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Coming up, Mitt Romney's problem with conservatives and what might come of Rick Santorum's night of victories.
I like that Santorum had a good showing so that he can push Romney to the right.
Also, it will soon be 30 years since Britain and Argentina went to war over the Falkland Islands.
Now, Britain has sent a destroyer to the South Atlantic. Argentina says the UN should curb British militarization of the Falklands.
It is routine. However, the symbolism of sending a more powerful militarized ship is one that at least some Argentines would take as a provocation.
Those stories in this hour of All Things Considered after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Lawmakers in Washington state have signed off on a Senate-passed bill legalizing same-sex marriage. The 55-43 vote to approve the measure, making Washington state the seventh in the nation to move to approve gay marriage. NPR's Martin Costi reports the governor's promise to sign the bill.
A confluence of political factors have come together to make this possible. The Democratic governor, Chris Gregoire, recently announced that she would support same-sex marriage. She hadn't done so in the past. And the supporters of same-sex marriage have been slowly but surely building up support for the idea. They've been sort of warming up the state for same-sex marriage by passing incrementally domestic partnership rights for same-sex couples, expanding those rights, and finally now actual marriage, using the term marriage for the first time.
NPR's Martin Costi. Washington state has had a domestic partner law on the books since 2007. Today's vote comes just one day after a federal appeals court declared California's ban on same-sex unions unconstitutional. There's nothing like a few victories to boost a candidate's fundraising, and Rick Santorum says he's collected $400,000 in just the past couple of days, including $250,000 following yesterday's wins in three states. NPR's Craig Windham looks at how Santorum's victories have shaken up the race.
Political analyst John McGlennon at the College of William & Mary says Santorum's wins are a significant setback for Mitt Romney, who will now have to stay focused on his GOP rivals.
It really makes it difficult for Romney to...